When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
From the Times and the Sunday Times, this is The Story. I'm Manveen Rana. The year is 1979. Amid military bands and much saluting, a big stately car adorned with flags drives up to a red carpet in Washington, D.C. Out steps the paramount leader of China, Deng Xiaoping, to a warm welcome from the American president, Jimmy Carter. This is a moment that will make history. America and China are about to sign an agreement, putting aside their differences.
Our two governments will implement full normalization of diplomatic relations. As a nation of gifted people who comprise about one-fourth of the total population of the earth, China plays already an important role in world affairs. A role that can only grow more important in the years ahead.
It was a moment that would go on to shape the way we live now. In the years that followed, China massively increased its trade with the West, something you can see evidence of all around you, every day.
Stuff we use on a day-to-day basis, including quite high-tech stuff like the laptop I'm speaking to you on today, is made in China.
China is now the world's largest exporter and the second largest economy. And if China's been winning on the manufacturing front, the next big vision for Xi Jinping is to dominate the world of tech, as a whistle-stop tour of modern China would show you.
Shanghai, Beijing chip manufacturers are in the southwest. There's a town called Mianyang, which is where Intel set up their first Chinese silicon chip manufacturing companies. Then Shenzhen is the fast-growing place where you're finding a lot of these new tech companies that are taking over, dominating some areas of what we think of as high tech.
What does China's focus on tech mean for the rest of the world? How serious a threat is it? Well, according to one former intelligence chief, this is the national security issue that will define our future.
We and our like-minded allies see technology as a way to enable greater freedoms, greater prosperity. But the Chinese leadership's approach is to also see it as a tool to gain advantage through control.
The story today, China's tech battle to win control of the future. Yeah, it's nice to be able to talk to you about China for a change.
Well, it's a bit of a change, but there you go. It's all geopolitics.
That's Richard Spencer, The Times' new China correspondent. We've heard from Richard a number of times on the podcast while he was reporting on the Middle East. And now, in his new role, he's been to Shenzhen to find out how China is racing ahead on the tech front and how it could soon overtake the West.
I've always been fascinated by China. I was there for 7 years before, 20 years ago, for the Telegraph. It was an amazing period to be there because it was the period coming up to the Beijing Olympics, and it was between the time when China joined the World Trade Organization and the Beijing Olympics, and that was just an extraordinary moment in modern history, really, certainly for China.
What a display case for the new China. This opening ceremony that we've just witnessed cost £3,000 a second. It is the most expensive, the most lavish, the most high-tech and innovative Olympic opening ceremony we have ever seen.
Its incredible economic growth was in supercharge, super turbo mode. It was an era of great optimism in the world. There was a lot of talk of globalization solving many of our social and economic issues, culminating in the global financial crisis when everything suddenly went into reverse. And I was in Beijing for that as well. And that was also fascinating, though obviously more stressful in many ways.
And Richard, you've recently been to Shenzhen, which is China's big tech hub. Tell us what it's like. For people who haven't been, just describe what it's like to be there. And, you know, how does it compare to, say, Silicon Valley?
Yeah, so Shenzhen is a fascinating place. And it's interesting that you should call it China's tech hub, because that's quite a new thing to call it a tech hub. I was last there more than 15 years ago and was curious to see what had happened. I'd heard many stories. It was a fishing village geographically close to Hong Kong. It was just over the mainland border from Hong Kong in the era when Hong Kong was run by Britain. You know, Hong Kong clothes companies moved their factories over into Shenzhen. A lot of these places in a whole string of towns up between Shenzhen and Guangzhou, the provincial capital of Guangdong province, which Shenzhen is in. Whole series of factory towns, just the low-cost manufacturing hub of China had sprung from this small beginnings in the early 1980s. And I wanted to go back, and suddenly it's got these amazing tech companies there, companies making software, making high-end electronics, mobile phones, computer chips. It has 18 million people living there. It's a city that's now three times the size of Hong Kong. It's one of the biggest cities in the world, and that's happened in just the last, as I say, 40 years since this all started. Incredible place.
And Richard, you chose to go to Shenzhen. Tell us why, and also just describe when you get there, what does it look like? Given that all of this has come up in 40 years, what does it now look like as a city?
So this was what I was interested in. You know, people told me that Shenzhen had changed a lot and that it was quite a cool place now. It was quite hip and a lot of funky things going on, if you like. And that kind of came as a surprise to me because it was, as I say, when I was last there, I wouldn't say it was grim, but it was a manufacturing place. But, you know, suddenly I was in a Hilton hotel by the river. I was looking out from my hotel over a yacht marina, over the water to the green hills of southern China. It was quite idyllic. Right next to my hotel was a art center. And there was this kind of bar or overlooking the water with a lawn in front of it, and people, young guys, young girls, were sitting on the lawn drinking beer. It was a kind of hipster. It was very hipster. And a lot of attention was clearly being given to the environment, to the shopping. There was a sports car, you know, outlet. I walked around the corner and there was a kind of entertainment complex with musical fountains and Tex-Mex restaurants and sushi joints and, of course, great Chinese restaurants. It was very cool.
Richard, you've arrived in China at a key moment when, you know, there's a lot of speculation that this is going to be China's century. That certainly seems to be Xi's vision for it. How is he setting about exerting Chinese supremacy around the world?
In many ways, the rise of China, the economic rise of China, has been umbilically linked to Western business, Western consumers who buy all those Chinese products. And so the last 20 years have been spent modernizing the armed forces, modernizing their economy, modernizing their whole mental infrastructure around securing the future of China. The next stage of that is to get themselves taken as an equal to America.
Is tech one of the battlegrounds in which they think they might be able to do that?
They are putting a huge amount of resources into tech for two reasons. One is that they don't want to be left behind. They don't want a situation whereby, should it come to conflict over Taiwan or somewhere, America has a military that's so technologically more advanced than China's that China can't compete. So it's putting a lot of investment into that side of things, R&D, space warfare, the high-tech challenge from military challenge. The second thing is it's, you know, economic planning. So the idea that it can sustain itself as can become the largest, it wants to be the largest economy in the world, is heading to become that at current rates in around 10 to 20 years' time. It will overtake America. It'll become the largest economy in the world by then. And it knows it's a manufacturing base. President Xi particularly does not want to see a consumer-driven society in the same way that America and Britain are consumer societies. He thinks that's a bit degenerate and also not sustainable in the long term. So he wants to sustain a manufacturing base, and he thinks that high tech, which are the current where the world is at the moment, means electric cars, solar panels, green technology, computer chips, all that stuff is the future. So that's the second reason why a lot of attention is put on places like Shenzhen and the companies based there to really spearhead the next wave of Chinese economic development.
With that as a backdrop, President Xi gave a speech recently in which he set out what seems to be one of the pillars of his great vision for the modern China, this idea of new productive forces. Tell us about that. What does that mean?
It was Xi who first came up with this last year. This phrase started to circulate. But the time it was really rammed down our throats was during the National People's Congress, which is the Chinese parliament.
Developing new quality productive forces does not mean neglecting or abandoning traditional industries.
It was exactly this development of high tech for its own sake and for productive forces to reboot the Chinese economy, which has had a bad few years. And they're going to reboot the economy looking at new tech, these green technologies, say electric cars, computer chips, all the rest of that. That's the focus for the next few years as part of the rejuvenation of China.
And what are the areas he wants that those new productive forces to really focus on?
They have put a lot of money into green technology, partly for their own sake. They had a real problem with pollution and environmental collapse, which was having consequences in terms of protests and popular opposition to schemes. They know that economic growth comes first, but they're aware that the future is greener. It's also economically sensible for them to do so. I mean, those solar panels have got cheaper, and they've got cheaper because China has the scale to produce anything more cheaper than anybody else, because it has still a relatively cheap labour force, and it has the scale of investment and the scale of production that can reduce prices. So it knows that it can produce electric cars en masse cheaper than anybody else. It can produce solar panels cheaper than anybody else. It can produce all these things that the West says it wants cheaper than anybody else. And that's a great economic drive. That's how it has, you know, become this economic power, by finding things that the rest of the world wants and making it cheaper than them.
Coming up, how Europe unintentionally helped China become a tech giant. That's in just a moment.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Richard, one of the ways that China is already making these huge technological advances and showing how successful it can be is through electric cars. Tell us the story of BYD, one of the companies based in Shenzhen, who I know you've been able to go and see.
Yes, I went to see BYD mainly because I've just been fascinated with this company for two decades.
We are BYD. You've probably never heard of us. So we could tell you that we are one of the largest manufacturers of new energy vehicles in the world.
They're just starting to hear a bit more about it because of electric cars. It started exporting more electric cars to Europe. It's actually built a factory in Hungary so that it can make stuff without attracting EU tariffs. Most of London's electric buses are being made by BYD in partnership with a European firm. So people are starting to hear this firm, but I sort of wanted to go and see it because I first came across it 20 years ago. I went to Shanghai Auto Fair in I think it was about 2005. And, you know, there was the usual scantily clad models over Ferraris and all that sort of stuff you find, or you used to find in auto shows in those days. I haven't been to one for ages, so I don't know if that is still going on, but there was certainly a lot of that. And then in the corner, there was this really cheaply built car that looked really as if it would crumple under a moderately charged electric can opener, again, with two scantily clad Chinese models draped over it. And I thought, what the hell is this? So there's a PR guy there, and I said, what's all this about? So this is BYD's latest model. I said, BYD, I've heard of that company. What's it do? I thought that made phone batteries. And they said, yeah, but we've decided to get into cars. And, oh, right, okay, good luck with that, mate. You don't look as if you're going to take on
Ferrari anytime soon.
VW, let alone Ferrari with that thing. And they say, well, it's work in progress. But then I looked it up, and there is this great story about BYD's founder, a man called Wang Chengfan. And he graduated from a fairly sort of second-tier science university in China in the 90s. And he decided to go into business, and he was quite entrepreneurial. He was first going to go get into air conditioners, and then someone said, no, that's the past, mate. You want to get into mobile phone batteries, that's the thing. So he went to South Korea, and he went on a tour of the Motorola, a factory that made batteries for Motorola mobile phones in South Korea. And it was classic South Korea factory of the era, incredibly modern robotic arms, sticking everything together. And he went around, they showed him around, and he said, what do these robots do? And they told him, and he took notes, and he then wrote to Motorola and said, I can make your batteries in China for half the price by replacing every robot with a human. Robots are the future
in cheap labor.
Robots are the future in places like Japan, where you've got an aging workforce. In China, we still have millions and millions of people coming into the labor market every year. We'll do it with cheap labor.
I imagine the factory he visited probably regretted letting him in.
They probably did, yeah. But it worked. And he became one of the biggest mobile phone battery makers in Shenzhen. And they still make mobile phone batteries, and they do a lot else. And he's a bit of a genius. And he saw the future in electric cars pretty early on. And that was why he was getting into cars, because he saw the synergy between making batteries and making cars. And I say that was less than 20 years ago. He got investment from Warren Buffett to expand, and expand he did. And in the fourth quarter of last year, his electric cars became the best-selling electric brand in the world, overtook Tesla. And he employs 700,000 people around the world, 50,000 in Shenzhen. And I went to see their campus, and it's an incredible, they call it a campus, it's an incredible thing.
What does it look like? What is it like when you're there?
It occupies this whole zone of Shenzhen. It's like its own little town. This campus, as they call it, it has its own primary school, for example. Even the PR people I was speaking to, they lived on site. They lived in modern apartment complexes built on this site. But certainly you just get an immense sense of immense scale. And also a certain amount of, there's a slightly freakish conformity about it. I saw it. There was a bunch of guys walking a sort of, not quite a sort of school type crocodile, but there was a certain crocodile element to it. There was about 40 young guys, all wearing identical grey suits and white shirts. And they were the new intake of marketing officers, apparently, who were going in for a training session. And they were all kind of like dressed identically. And there was this sort of strong sense of identity by uniformity, if you like, and adherence to corporate values through uniformity. Meanwhile, the PR people, of course, have to deal with people like me, and they have to deal with consumers, and they have to deal with the outward-facing stuff. They're very hip and young and jeans-wearing and cool. So there's a kind of, it's quite an insight into this sort of multifaceted nature of modern China, where it still has some of this sort of the conformity that you associate with communism, if you like, but also with Confucianism, and I'd say maybe old-fashioned British socialist values in some way, this sense of community spirit. And also the awareness that there has to be sort of an individuality aspect to it as well. And certainly if you're going to sell consumer products like cars, you have to make them appealing to the individual, because the car is, after all, the great symbol of modern individualism.
That's fascinating. And Richard, you mentioned that BYD received investment from the American billionaire Warren Buffett, and they've also had help from the Chinese government. How well is it doing abroad? Have the markets in the West also helped BYD in its progress?
This is the next big question. So they have huge plans for selling cars to the West. The Chinese market is 60% of the Chinese market is now electric cars. It's well ahead of the West in the shift towards electric cars from fossil fuel cars, from diesel and petrol cars. But they're overproducing, so they need an export market, and they want to challenge the big Western car brands on that. BYD, for example, has built its own super container ships. You know, it decided there wasn't enough capacity for its ambition in, you know, car container ships, which kind of have to be specialist in, you know, a specialist thing to transport cars around the world. And they decided there weren't enough of those on the floating around on the high seas. So it built eight of its own. And the first one of those docked in Europe for the first time earlier this year. It could be a symbolic moment, containing BYD cars for the European market. Having said that, you don't find electric cars at the top of the bestseller list yet in Europe. They're a long way behind, and there's a brand value issue. People don't really trust Chinese cars yet. So they have got that big obstacle to come to overturn. And the European Union and America are, however, both terrified. They're really worried that they're going to eat the market eventually, one way or another.
Well, that's a key point, really, isn't it? Because as you say, Europe and America are now starting to panic about BYD's, you know, flooding the market. But up until now, in a way, one of the differences between the West and China has always been our approach to the economy. We are, you know, we fundamentally believe in free markets, whereas China is a much more command economy. The government does get properly involved. In a way, is this a moment where perhaps we should reconsider our model? Because have our free market tactics and even some of our own government subsidies made life much easier for BYD rather than for many of the firms here?
Yeah, there's this great irony in Europe, which is, the European Union is based on setting free market rules and stopping a sort of nuclear arms race of government subsidies, that they will subsidize consumers for things that are seen as social goods. So they're subsidizing, or governments are allowed to subsidize, even encouraged to subsidize, the purchase of electric vehicles as part of the goal that most European countries have to phase out new petrol cars or diesel cars from 2035. As people have pointed out, this, since it's a subsidy, it's effectively to the consumer through car taxes, European Union is effectively subsidizing the Chinese car industry, because if you buy a Chinese car, you get the subsidy as well. Meanwhile, China is using cheap loans and various other interventions to subsidize its car industry, so the Chinese car industry gets the boon both ways. And that's definitely a serious issue. The other background point here, of course, is the election of Donald Trump in 2016. It's a controversial issue, why Trump got elected, but one of the reasons often cited is that although the free market and globalization, and which in America and Europe, cases often meant outsourcing industrial production to China where it could be done more cheaply, although that it makes macroeconomic sense, you know, we all benefit from the lower prices that involves, that allows us to spend hard-earned money and spend less of it on TVs and laptops and more of it on going out to dinner, and that sort of equalizes the economy. What 2016 and the election of Trump focused on, and that's that the losses are concentrated in industrial areas which saw all their factories closed down, and that created this sort of angry industrial, post-industrial heartland in America, which all went out and voted for Donald Trump.
The United States lost over 3 million manufacturing jobs, nearly a quarter of all steel jobs, and 60,000 factories after China joined the WTO. And we have racked up $13 trillion in trade deficits over the last two decades. But those days are over.
And that was a wake-up call that, you know, it's not just all about overall GDP per head. You have to focus on things, on certain geographical places that suffer badly. And also, you're giving away your infrastructure base, and that has strategic implications as well. You've given away your supply chains to the enemy in China's case. So this whole issue is being revisited, and that's quite important.
And Richard, how is America and Europe, how are the West reacting to China's success in technology?
So there's two drivers of this. There's the security side and there's the economic side. In the last couple of years, it's become turbocharged because of fears in America. The West has woken up to the fact that China is now a superpower. It can stand in the way of Western interests. And that very much that the assimilation of China into Western supply chains, whereby so much of our stuff we use on a day-to-day basis, including quite high-tech stuff like the laptop I'm speaking to you on today, is made in China. And the second driver for that Western fear was the coronavirus pandemic, when supply chains were disrupted, when certain products suddenly became vitally important. The only place that makes them was China. And suddenly, you know, the supply chains were cut off. Global trade came to a standstill. So suddenly people were very aware that there was a downside to this globalization, particularly a downside when it comes to a global power that was often hostile to Western interests. So President Biden has put sanctions on the transfer of quite a lot of technology to China, including high-end computer chip. Well, they're actually made by Taiwanese firms using American patented technology. And Biden, he put a block on some of these technologies being transferred and punished firms that continue to try and transfer this technology to Chinese companies.
President Biden signed an executive order that blocks certain national security technologies and products in countries of concern, including China.
Senior administration officials say that the order stems from national security goals rather than economic interests.
So Xi Jinping understandably said, right, we've got to develop this tech ourselves. So suddenly companies were encouraged, and they themselves, of course, had their own economic incentive to start, you know, trying to produce their own high-end chips. So Huawei, the great Chinese competitor to Apple, making mobile phones, massive manufacturer of lots of tech products, has been working with a Chinese chip manufacturer to try and match the high-end chip used in Apple iPhones. And so that's the interface, if you like, between security in terms of keeping China a little bit behind America in terms of high tech, because it wants America strategically and militarily and in all those ways wants to take a tech lead. And of course, China wants to reverse that on both counts.
Richard, having been to Shenzhen, having seen how much it's sort of developed and how quickly things are growing, how soon do you think China might overtake the US in terms of technology?
There's an argument that so long as China maintains its tight control over personal freedom and academic freedom, that it can't overtake the West, that the innovative mindset that the Silicon Valley has is a product ultimately of its freer society. It's a more developed education system that depends on innovation and less on rote learning and less on Confucian ideas of authority, leaving aside the communist aspect. Social media is a great one, because the idea behind social media doesn't depend on tech. It depends on free association. The tech is there to put that into practice. If you didn't have the sort of free association you would have in the West, would you even have bothered to come up with the tech that underlies social media and algorithms and things like that? China's copied all of those, and it's got its own models of all these Western social media companies, the Western social media companies being banned. China has its own censored space. Would China have come up with that on its own? That's a good question. You know, can you do that in a world where no one expects to be able to communicate freely? So there is a sort of almost philosophical question about whether China can overtake the West. Nevertheless, in certain areas, actual production of computer chips and certain high-tech products, it'll be 5 years before China overtakes the West in some areas. And it has a huge number now of very highly educated engineers and thinkers around these things. But certainly China's, the scale that China can operate at makes it a rival to America in terms of tech, even if actually it's not so innovative and futuristic in its thinking.
That's Richard Spencer, The Times' new China correspondent, on his recent visit to Shenzhen. You can read more of his coverage of the region, including his latest report on the first victim of the Hong Kong national security law, a man who used to dress up as Captain America during the protests, at thetimes.co.uk with a subscription. The producer today was Priyanka Dalladia. The executive producer is Kate Ford, and sound design and theme tune were by Mao Lasetto. If you want to get in touch, do drop us a line to thestory@thetimes.co.uk. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.